content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Michael Wrigley here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. The program today is generously underwritten by White Memorial Presbyterian Church, to whom thanks. They can be reached at 919-834-3424. And from The Economist, first of August 26th, Religion and Society in Ireland. Ireland wrestles with Catholicism as the religion plunges in popularity. Where does the country stand on the spectrum from Catholic to post-Catholic? When this weekend's visit to Ireland by Pope Francis is over, people around the world will have picked up some confusing messages about a land long revered as a cradle of saints and religious scholars. On one hand, the Irish Republic is much less Catholic than it was in 1979, when a previous pontiff, John Paul II, toured the island and electrified its people. On the other, the Catholic faith retains a large residual strength. For better or worse, the Catholic faith, or memories of the faith, still influence those who are outside its ranks. As we write elsewhere, the share of Irish people who say they attend Mass regularly has fallen to barely 3 in 10 from 8 in 10 a few decades ago. But this still makes Ireland one of the more devout nations in Europe. Among Irish citizens aged between 16 and 29, nearly 40% say they have no religion. But then 91% of Czechs, 75% of Swedes, and 70% of Britons in that age bracket deny any religious affiliation. And a remarkably high 31% of young Irish people say they pray at least once a week. Even if some are fibbing, it is telling that they choose to make that claim. So where exactly does Ireland stand on that spectrum between Catholic and post-Catholic? In many countries, the collapse in the prestige of the priesthood and of religious orders has been much more dramatic than the decline of belief itself. At Ireland's main seminary, the number of young men who start training for the priesthood each year has fallen to single figures. When Catholic fervor was at its height in the mid-20th century, it was in the hundreds. The average age for Irish priests is around 70, and a desperate shortage of priests is expected. However, some forms of popular religion, especially ones in which the role of priests is not central, can still attract large numbers. These include pilgrimages to holy mountains, wells, and shrines. Novenas, set-piece prayers over a 9-day period, can pull in the faithful, especially if they honor a locally popular saint. Books about angelic visitations, such as those by Lorna Byrne, a Dublin woman, still command a following, even in rough parts of the city. And what about the Irish intelligentsia, a world where both piety and skepticism have deep cultural roots? One would be hard-pressed these days to name many Irish cultural figures, writers, or public intellectuals who are practicing Catholics. Descriptions of Catholic piety, from the tender to the sarcastic, are a commonplace of Irish fiction and film. But Ireland has not generated Catholic writers comparable to the English converts like Evelyn Waugh or Graham Greene. One of the few public figures who emphatically identifies as Catholic, former President Mary McAleese, is also a fierce critic of the Church, calling it criminally homophobic. Much has changed at the University College Dublin, Ireland's biggest place of secular higher learning. It was founded in 1854 as a Catholic-friendly alternative to Trinity College, a grand old bastion of Anglicanism in the heart of Dublin. In its early years, a Catholic ethos pervaded its liberal arts faculties. These days, a Catholic philosopher is a rarity. Yet currents of thought which emerged out of European Catholicism, existentialism, for example, are still more popular in the Irish Academy than they would be in most Anglophone countries. This may not be a Catholic cultural environment, but it is post-Catholic in a way that France is and England isn't. And there is one paradoxical point of agreement among many thoughtful observers of Ireland, Catholic and otherwise, from the older generation. On one hand, the collapse of the former Catholic theocracy with its brutality, hypocrisy, and cynicism is welcome. But some good things may have been thrown out along with that filthy bathwater. Take David Norris, a senator and literary scholar who, at 74, is the grand old man of Ireland's gay rights movement, and, as it happens, a practicing Anglican. He has more reason than anybody to look back on the old Catholic order, which criminalized his sexuality, with horror. But he still considers it a pity that some of the decency and courtesy and everyday behavior that Catholic education used to inculcate, along with many terrible things, has vanished and has not been replaced with any convincing substitute. The net result, he and many others feel, has been a coarser and more materialistic tone in national life. Peter White, a public affairs consultant who was also raised in Irish Anglicanism, puts it this way. 30 years ago, I was an outsider amongst doctrinaire Catholic religiosity. Now I'm an outsider amongst the New Ireland's equally doctrinaire, naive materialism. Both diminish us as moral agents. It's not an easy viewpoint to place on any linear spectrum or explain to a visiting pope, but perhaps it's what makes Ireland intriguing. And now from the Religion News Service of August 31st. A church-state watchdog is demanding a halt to meetings between the Trump administration and an informal group of evangelical advisors who have proved to be among the president's staunchest supporters. Americans United for Separation of Church and State said the group is violating the Federal Advisory Committee Act, a 1972 law that provides transparency and procedural standards for committees created to meet with the executive branch. The watchdog called for a stop to the group's meetings and advising unless and until it complies with the law. It is clear that the president's evangelical advisory board is doing substantive work with the Trump administration behind closed doors, without any sunlight for the public to understand how and why decisions are being made, wrote Americans United Associate Legal Director Alex J. Lukinster in a Thursday, August 30th letter addressed to White House counsel Don McGahn and other administration officials. It was also sent to Johnny Moore, who has served as an unofficial spokesman for the evangelical group. The letter comes in the same week that President Trump hosted a dinner for close to 100 evangelicals in the White House's state dining room. The president welcomed them on Monday by saying, quote, "These are very special friends of mine, evangelical pastors and leaders from all across the nation." Ticking off the names of leaders in attendance, including Florida megachurch pastor Paula White, evangelist Franklin Graham, and Liberty University president Jerry Falwell Jr., Trump added, "I know you, I watch you, I see you. Yours are the words we want to hear." Evangelicals who have met with the Trump administration have told Religion News Service that they have discussed a range of policy issues, from abortion to transgender rights to international religious freedom. The administration continues to engage hundreds of faith leaders on various issues that directly impact their communities, said Hogan Gidley, deputy press secretary to RNS. The White House does not have an evangelical advisory board. Instead, the president signed an executive order establishing the White House Faith and Opportunity Initiative that serves all faith-based communities. Rachel Laser, president of Americans United, called for a greater transparency about the advisors. President Trump has granted leaders of a narrow segment of one religion unprecedented influence on policy decisions that affect all of us, said Laser. Americans have a right to know that and to have a government that works for everyone, not just some. In the letter, Lukinster said the activities of the advisory group are well within FACA scope. Moore, responding to a request from RNS for comment, denied the group has any official capacity. There has never been, and I know of no plans for there to be, a White House faith or evangelical council. It's hard to shut down something that doesn't legally exist. He said that there had been, quote, confusion about the group because members of the media innocently chose to carry over language used in the campaign into coverage of the administration, but that campaign council was officially disbanded after the campaign. Moore also said Americans United complaint seems primarily to be a fundraising ploy by the watchdog. Others have previously shunned the name Faith Council as an appropriate description. Dallas megachurch pastor Robert Jeffress has told RNS that would come with certain legal ramifications. When Press Secretary Sarah Sanders responded to a question about a July 2017 meeting at which photos appeared on social media of evangelical leaders praying for Trump, she defended the prayer and added, "It's his faith advisory board, and they meet from time to time to speak about issues that are important to that community." Melissa Rogers, the former director of President Obama's White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, has told RNS the Obama administration's faith-based councils produced public reports, held public meetings, and were subject to the 1972 law. She tweeted on Tuesday after reports of this week's dinner, "Once again, the Trump White House appears to favor evangelicals, more specifically a particular kind of evangelical, over others, while claiming to promote religious freedom." Americans United has also sent Freedom of Information Act requests to 10 federal agencies seeking information about administration meetings and communications with the evangelical advisors. It also seeks to determine the sources of funding for the dinner. Rob Boston, Americans United spokesman, said his advocacy group hopes for a response to its letter from the White House, though one is not required. "The federal government doesn't have to respond to our FOIA requests," he said. And now from the Associated Press of August 31st. Roman Catholic officials in Pennsylvania began lining up quickly and publicly with a key state legislative ally in backing the creation of a victims' compensation fund as an alternative to allowing victims in decades-old child sexual abuse cases to sue the church in court. Erie Bishop Lawrence Persico said he would collaborate in the creation of a compensation fund that is administered by a neutral third party, while the Philadelphia Archdiocese and the Harrisburg and Allentown Diocese suggested they are open to the idea. Allowing lawsuits to be heard in courts, however, would force bigger payouts by the church and force the church to disclose more about clergymen who preyed on children and a church hierarchy that helped cover it up, say victim advocates. A fight over the competing ideas could arrive in the state legislature next month on the heels of a state grand jury report released this month that said about 300 clergymen had sexually abused at least 1,000 children over seven decades in six dioceses. The report prompted new calls for changing state law to allow adults abused as children to sue in court, even if they had been barred by a prior time limit in law. "It is a change in state law that bishops have successfully fought in recent years, even as a handful of other states have opened such windows to let victims sue the church." Catholic Church officials maintain that such a so-called reviver law is unconstitutional in Pennsylvania, though legal scholars disagree over the question. Current law gives victims of child sexual abuse until they turn 30 to file a lawsuit. The Philadelphia Archdiocese said Wednesday, August 29th, that it has paid more than $10 million in recent years to help hundreds of victims, regardless of whether their claims are barred by time limits in state law. "Thus, we are receptive to any fair and reasonable program to help victims whose cases are barred," it said in a statement. The state Senate's top Republican floated the idea Wednesday of a compensation fund, though the chamber's top Democrat said church officials privately had been discussing setting up a $250 million fund well before. However, the grand jury and state attorney general Josh Shapiro urged the legislature to change state law to provide a two-year window for victims to sue, and many lawmakers expect the state House of Representatives will approve such a provision after voting sessions resume in September. The Pennsylvania Catholic Conference, which speaks for all the state's dioceses, declined comment on whether it had discussed a $250 million compensation fund or whether it opposes a two-year window. University of Pennsylvania Professor Marcy Hamilton, a veteran plaintiff's attorney in child sex abuse cases who heads the Philadelphia-based Child USA research organization, said it is fine to create a compensation fund similar to the one in New York, but it is also necessary to allow victims to sue. "These compensation funds are no substitute for real justice, which is what you get with a retroactive window." In New York, the public has learned little about abuse cases, given the number of victims who have been paid, Hamilton said. The Archdiocese of New York said last year that its independent reconciliation and compensation program drew more than 200 applications through its November 1st deadline, with compensation totaling $40 million on 189 claims. Jeffrey R. Anderson, a veteran Minnesota-based plaintiff's attorney in child sex abuse cases, said the courts promise more transparency, more protection for children, and more money for victims. They would get a fraction of what they could recover in a court of law, Anderson said. One Catholic lawmaker, Senator John Utechak, Democrat of Lucerne, said he would worry that legislation that attempts to help victims by allowing them to sue is challenged and struck down by the courts. A safer bet might be the compensation fund, Utechak said. Perhaps this is the best way we can respect the rule of law and respect the rights of victims who want to seek justice for the crimes that have been committed against them, he said. And now from Reuters of August 31st. A Michigan child's death puts the spotlight on a clash between medicine and religion. In 34 states and the District of Columbia, there are religious exemptions to child neglect and abuse laws. That means a parent can deny medical care for reasons based on religion. The case of a Michigan couple charged in the death of their 10-month-old daughter is bringing to light a debate about withholding medical care because of religious beliefs. Seth Welch and his wife, Tatiana Fusari, both 27, were charged with felony murder and first-degree child abuse after their daughter, Mary, died earlier this month from malnutrition and dehydration, an autopsy revealed. The parents said they didn't seek medical help for their daughter because of their religious beliefs, although they declined to define their religion. I believe I am being unfairly charged, made an example of for my very strong faith, Welch told Wood TV in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Going into the doctor's office these days is just about as dangerous as not going. Every state in the U.S. has laws protecting children from abuse and neglect, but in those 34 states in the District of Columbia, there are exemptions if it conflicts with their religious beliefs, according to Pew Research Center. There are also religious exemptions to manslaughter laws in at least six states, Pew reported. However, in many states, including Michigan, those exceptions are not absolute. The Michigan case, among others, is raising questions about whether these laws should be changed. But sometimes it's difficult to protect both religious freedom and the health of a child, said Dr. Ray Barfield, professor of pediatrics and Christian philosophy at Duke University. There's going to be some things that are downright abuse that could be legally justified by saying it's part of my religion. At the same time, the consequences of simply dismissing protection for a range of religious expression is going to have some consequences that probably even the people who are arguing for are not going to like. Some religious groups, including Christian Scientists and the Idaho-based Followers of Christ, either recommend or mandate faith-based healing instead of traditional medicine. In 2016, a state government task force concluded that five children in Idaho died 3 years earlier because their parents did not seek medical treatment for them due to their religious beliefs. Studies in the 1980s and 90s have also documented measles outbreaks and high mortality rates among Christian Scientists. Since Idaho enacted a faith-based healing exemption in the 1970s, child advocates estimate more than 180 children have died or were stillborn in families that practiced a religion that shuns modern medicine. Religious exemptions in civil and criminal child abuse laws are linked to the 1974 Federal Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, which was construed to mean that states were required to implement faith-based healing exemptions, according to Pew. That interpretation was later overturned, but by then, states had already passed a handful of laws that included them. Christian Scientists and Followers of Christ aren't the only religious groups that reject traditional medical care. Jehovah's Witnesses will not receive blood transfusions, the Amish will not undergo heart transplants and sometimes heart surgery, and some groups of Hindus, Sikhs, and Muslims do not allow the use of animal-based products when they receive medical treatment. Barfield said that many religious groups will turn down certain types of medical care because they believe the consequence is eternal damnation. If you put eternal damnation against taking a flu shot, probably the flu shot's going to lose, he says. But Barfield says doctors shouldn't completely write off patients who object to medical care due to religious reasons. Duke's Theology, Medicine, and Culture program seeks to teach medical students how to understand how different religious beliefs can clash with medical care. As physicians, we depend on families trusting us, but understanding that we're human, he says. It seems to me that we can at least return the favor and show them the respect by, as they try to figure out the world in their own messy way, including religiously messy ways. And back to the Religious and Religion News Service now of August 30th. India's B'nai Menashe community sets sights on immigrating to Israel. Wearing a pale yellow tallit, the traditional Jewish prayer shawl, Aharon Vaivhei points to a map of Jerusalem at the Shaive Israel Hebrew Center in Manipur in northeastern India. "This is the land of our ancestors," said Vaivhei, 32, a B'nai Menashe Jew who hopes to make Aliyah, in other words, immigration to Israel, this year. Vaivhei's dream is shared by the estimated 7,000 B'nai Menashe Jews who are scattered across the rural agrarian landscape of Manipur and neighboring Mizoram. They are keen to return to what they consider their ancient homeland. The B'nai Menashe claim to be descended from one of the ten lost tribes of Israel that were exiled by the Assyrian Empire in about 740 BC, even though there's no historical record of this. Their pamphlets, based on oral tradition, recount how the B'nai Menashe escaped slavery and made their way to Afghanistan, China, and Burma before settling in northeast India. To this day, they believe their origins are different from the local Indian populations. Despite local variation in interpretation of the Israelite claim, they've published many pamphlets representing different groups which have emerged over the past two decades claiming an Israelite connection, said Shalva Weil, a senior researcher at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in Israel. So far in 2018, more than 430 B'nai Menashe have immigrated to Israel, making it one of their largest exoduses from India since 1989. More are expected to make Aliyah, given stronger economic and political ties between India and Israel, and formal recognition of the B'nai Menashe by some Israeli rabbis. The bettering of relations between India and Israel and a flush of funds has possibly prompted the migration, said Thangam Amisu Singsit, chairman of the B'nai Menashe Council in Manipur. But more importantly, our Jewish ancestry has finally been recognized. It's been a long, winding path to Israel for the B'nai Menashe, who have made Aliyah. In 1983, Orthodox Rabbi Eliyahu Avichai scoured the world for the 10 lost tribes and encouraged B'nai Menashe to return to Israel. The B'nai Menashe's move to Israel got a boost from when Michael Freund, a former aide to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, set up a nonprofit, Shavei Israel, in 2002 to help the B'nai Menashe reclaim their roots. A 2005 rabbinical ruling by Shlomo Amar determined that the B'nai Menashe were, quote, seed of Israel, a term for those who are considered Jewish not by religious law but by ancestry. But a government document obtained by the Israeli newspaper Haaretz in 2015 revealed that Amar had, in fact, ruled that B'nai Menashe did not have an established Jewish ancestry. The Israeli government at the time turned down the mass immigration plan. "We were anxiously waiting to immigrate to Israel. This was a big setback for our community," said Samuel Haukip, a B'nai Menashe leader from Chara Chanbur. When Netanyahu was re-elected prime minister in 2009, Freund again found support for his claim that B'nai Menashe are the living bridge between India and Israel. The chief rabbinate of Israel, too, accepted them as Jews for their devotion, but said they would have to undergo formal conversion in order to become naturalized citizens. Freund began education and conversion services at the Shavei Israel centers in Manipur and Mizoram. Once in Israel, the B'nai Menashe go through a ritual conversion. After that, Freund's nonprofit helps them scout for housing, education, and employment in Israel. Upon completion of their education, the B'nai Menashe are granted citizenship. Their exodus from India hasn't gone without criticism. Haaretz report claimed that the return operation has been fraught with questionable government decisions, an ambiguous rabbinical ruling, and potential conflicts of interest. The report noted that new B'nai Menashe arrivals weren't provided housing in settlements on the West Bank. Rather, they were dispatched to locations in northern Israel where conservatives perceived an Arab threat to the local Jewish people. The report revealed that the community hadn't integrated well into Israeli society, but that they fear if they speak out, it could affect chances of their relatives being placed on the lists of those deemed eligible for emigration to Israel. When India Prime Minister Narendra Modi visited Israel last July, hundreds of B'nai Menashe immigrants gathered to greet him. The strategic partnership between India and Israel has reached a new height, said Sushil Kumar, Deputy Secretary of India's Ministry of External Affairs. When two countries are in sync with each other, migration of people is a natural outcome. Many B'nai Menashe inhabit Manipur's remote Charochandur district. The 23 tribal communities living in villages framed by low-lying hills are subsistence farmers. While it's important for them to make aliyah, they also seek upward social and financial mobility. Yehuda Kongsai, a 25-year-old community leader from Kochichang, is on the wait list for making aliyah. Not only do I want to get the full flavor of Jewish life in Israel, but also have access to better employment opportunities, he said. Kongsai was interviewed by rabbis and Sheve Israel officials who came to Manipur in 2015 to select eligible candidates. These interviews assess our commitment to Judaism. The families that clear the test emigrate in small batches. Other B'nai Menashe are eager to break new ground in a foreign country, but before that, the Hebrew centers in Manipur and Mizoram, microcosms of what they believe to be the Promised Land, initiate them into Judaism. Within the precincts of Manipur's Hebrew center, the faithful offer prayers at the Beit Shalom Synagogue, which boasts two Torah scrolls encased in ornamental closets. When the cantor reads from the Siddur, or Jewish prayer book, the devotees chant prayers in Hebrew. Later, the devotees gather in the open hall for community events. Some learn Hebrew in a library that has basic resources materials on Judaism, while married women use the mikveh for ritual purification. This is my universe and a place of refuge, said Ruth, a 32-year-old community member from an adjoining neighborhood. Throughout Elul, the Hebrew month, she makes penitential prayers at the synagogue. This time, too, I'm praying for Aliyah. The Hebrew Center is just a stepping stone for embracing Jewish life. Doron, a student from one of Charochandur's remote villages, believes he can make a mark in the Israeli Defense Forces. My friend made Aliyah a few years back and underwent military training in Israel. My lifelong dream is to serve in the Defense Forces, he said. Other young converts have professional aspirations. They want to undergo training to become English teachers, computer technicians, and engineers. And older B'nai Menashe want to fulfill their cherished dream of full absorption within Israel society. Our forefathers continued to practice Judaism, including observing Sabbath, keeping kosher, and following the laws of family purity. It's time we turn to the land of our ancestors, said Yevelin Halkip, 70, chairman of the Beit Shalom Synagogue. My grandmother had said India is our residence, but Israel is our home. We just want to go back home. Well, that's all the time we have now for Religion in the News. Thanks very much for listening. Again, sponsored by White Memorial Presbyterian Church, 919-834-3424. This has been Michael Blakely. I'll talk to you later.